From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me?
On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Ringo Starr about life before, during, and after the Beatles. Today is the first day of his international tour with a new all-star band. Recently, he recorded again with Paul and George for a forthcoming TV documentary about the Beatles. Also today, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Independence Day, Richard Ford's sequel to his novel The Sports Writer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
What do I do when my love is away?
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm Ringo, and I play the drums.
Well, I'm Paul, and I play the bass.
I'm George, and I play a guitar.
I'm John, and I too play a guitar. Sometimes I play the fool.
It's a special day on Fresh Air, the first time we've had a former Beatle as a guest. My guest is Ringo Starr. Today he begins a world tour with a performance in Japan. He's put together an all-star band that includes his son Zach, who is also a drummer, as well as John S. Entwistle of The Who, Felix Cavalieri of The Young Rascals, and Randy Bachman of Bachman Turner Overdrive. The all-star band comes to the States at the beginning of July to perform in such cities as St. Louis, Milwaukee, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Boston, and Atlantic City. Last year, Ringo did something that Beatles fans have long hoped for. He reunited with Paul McCartney and George Harrison and performed for a forthcoming TV documentary called The Beatles Anthology. Before Ringo began his tour, I spoke with him about his life before, during, and after the Beatles. First, I asked him why he decided to go back on tour.
Every couple of years, I feel I should get out there and do something, and this is what I do. So I was out in '92. I was out first out in the first band I ever put together was in 1989, the All Stars, and then in '92. So it's sort of time for me to do it again, really.
This is another All Star band.
Another All Star band.
What do you like about All Star bands?
I think the really good thing for me about the All-Star Band is that, I don't have to carry all the weight. The other All-Stars take the limelight too. And it's good for me because I can play drums with them. And then also I can come down to the front, which I never really did before, and entertain from the front while on this tour my son Zach will play drums. So it has all those advantages of, I'm not up there for 2 or 3 hours singing all my songs, which I don't have.
Now, I know that you're featured in a forthcoming 10-hour-long television documentary on the Beatles called The Beatle Anthology. And you perform on it, I understand, with Paul and George.
Yeah.
What inspired you to get together for this documentary? I know it's something that you've all resisted for years.
Yeah, well, this thing's been put together. It was first put together in 1970, a long time ago. And so we finally, through Apple and Neil Aspinall, a good friend of ours, we finally put it together. But it needed something new instead of it just being like the documentary. And so we all decided to be involved ourselves. So we are interviewed also to give our side of the story. And the follow-on for that was we were all interviewed separately, and then, of course, we decided we'd be interviewed together. And the follow-on to that was, well, why don't we make some music for it? And the problem we had with that, well, yes, it's real easy that Paul, George and Ringo can go in the studio and make this music, but that's not the Beatles. So we needed something that, you know, it would still be the Beatles. And Yoko came up with a couple of tracks of John's that have never been out there, just demos, really. So we really worked on them to get them, you know, clean enough and usable enough, really. And we put them down on 24-track, and then we all worked with that. So it just seemed like, you know, it's a natural progression. We're all loose enough to do this together now. And it made it real easy because now John's in it.
Through the demo?
Through the tape, yeah.
What was it like playing together again?
It was very emotional. I mean, it was very emotional, first of all, listening to John on the tape. You know, because he is not here, but his voice was there. And then, you know, we had to, you know, we all called each other and spoke about it. You know, we had to say, okay, well, are we going to do this? You know, it's pretty strange. And we came to the conclusion that, well, what we'll do is we'll just feel, you know, we'll just sort of say, well, John's gone on holiday for a while or he's gone for a cup of tea. And that's how we got into it. So it felt okay, you know. But we still have the difficulty of, you know, the three of us doing anything. So it was a lifesaver, really.
Were there emotional things that had stood in the way of the three of you performing before?
Well, yes, we were all angry with each other.
Was it over money or music or personality?
It was over personality. It was over lifestyles. It was over, you know, a million different things over the years that, you know, we all like the family that have good years and bad years. And we just had quite a few bad years lately. But that's all sort of broken down now where, you know, the first time the three of us got together to actually do the music was very strange. You know, it was all like, here we are. But, you know, 20 minutes in, it was cool. We were laughing. We were having fun.
Did you all fall into some of the same patterns that you used to?
Sure, we all sort of have our personalities, you know, our own personalities, but we also have our personalities within the group. And they sort of started coming out and showing themselves again.
But I mean, it's been like 25 years, so your personalities have all changed a little.
Oh, yeah. Yes, but, you know, it's still when you put that combination together, you get a similar attitude. Mm-hmm. And we know each other so well. I mean, we were so close, you know, through the 60s and through the 70s and 80s. It wasn't like we never spoke to each other or we never met. We just had never worked together. So over the last 3 years, we've been working together on and off. So, you know, the ice was melting really fast.
Do you know when that was going to be broadcast in America?
It's in November. It's going to be, I think, 5 hours of it on ABC in November. There's actually 12 hours of it, but that's a little long for TV. Though I thought it would be great to start at 12 o'clock in the afternoon and go till 12 midnight. It would be fabulous.
A marathon.
But they've cut it down to 5 hours, and it's on ABC sometime in November.
There's a box set of Beatles recordings that were made at the BBC in the 1960s when you were regular guests on a radio show.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite track from that we can play?
Baby, It's You. Is that on there?
Yes.
Why don't you play that one?
Why'd you choose it?
I choose it because it's really a smooth track. I'm trying to drag up my memory of all those tracks because there's like 50 of them on the record. And I felt that one was really smooth and, you know, it was real easy and it sounded great.
Okay.
You kiss that tears me apart. Well, many, many, many nights roll by. I sit alone at home and I cry over you. What can I do? Can't help myself. 'Cause baby, it's you.
Sha-la-la-la.
Baby, it's you.
Oh, my guest is Ringo Starr. Can we talk a little bit about life before the Beatles?
Sure.
Well, you grew up in Liverpool. What was your neighborhood like?
Well, I was born at a very early age.
Yeah, right.
My neighborhood was real working class. I remember being conscious from a very early age that I wanted to get out of there because it was dark. It was just dark. It was just a dark neighborhood, you know. It was like they needed more street lights at night. But, of course, it was my neighborhood as a child, and I have, you know, wonderful memories of it. And the thrilling thing is that, you know, my memory of it, because I'd left it for years, was like, you know, this childhood memory that I had all these big avenues that we used to walk down. And then I went back and there's all these really narrow streets. So the memory plays games. But it was a loving neighborhood. I mean, the school was 3 minutes walk away. So, you know, it was a real neighborhood. There was a pub on nearly every corner, which I got to a little later. You know, and that, there was a park I used to walk to. One of my ambitions, which my mother used to tell me often, was I wanted to be a tramp. And so we used to walk everywhere. One of the reasons was, of course, because we couldn't afford to take a car or take a limo in those days, or a bus even. So we used to walk a lot. And I used to love that. And there was parks around us. So it was a very poor neighborhood, but childhood memories make it quite romantic.
I know your father left the family, I think, when you were three.
Yeah, he'd had enough.
So did your mother have a way of making money?
Yeah, she worked any job she could find. You know, I mean, I come from a working class family, but they call it lower working class when you've only got one parent. But my mother, God bless her, she did anything from scrubbing steps to working in a fruit shop to working in pubs, anything she could to support us, because he forgot that part of the bargain.
Right. Mm. Now, I know when you were young, you had two long hospital stays.
Mm-hmm.
When you were six, your appendix burst, and you ended up getting an internal infection.
Peritonitis, it's called, yeah. And that was pretty dangerous. It's still dangerous today, but in 1947, it was very dangerous.
So you were in the hospital for about a year.
I was in a year because 6 months in, I was getting rather well. And I got excited, and I fell out the bed.
Oh, no.
And ripped open all these stitches in my stomach, so they had to dive in again and sew me up.
Oh, gosh.
So we're lucky to be here, Terry.
Yeah. Well, then you got sick again when you were 13.
I know.
Well, tuberculosis, was it?
Yeah, but that was from the area I lived in.
Industrial stuff?
Where I lived, like, not every other home, but it was like, you know, six or seven cases in every street where people were just in the living room dying of TB because they didn't have a cure, of course. Right. And again, God, you know, shone his light on me. In 1953 or 54, when they discovered streptomycin, and that's what saved me. So they shipped me off to a greenhouse in the country.
A greenhouse? Is it like a sanitarium?
Yeah, just a huge greenhouse where instead of flowers, they put all his kids in there. And let us breathe some decent air for a change and gave us streptomycin. And a year later, I came out of there.
Did you, when you were a kid, think that you were going to die as a child?
I don't know if that really crossed my mind about I'm going to die. I really knew I was ill, and the doctors felt I was going to die three times, but we proved them wrong. So I was pretty ill, but I don't think I was thinking, oh, I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that came into my mind.
So were you pretty frail during most of your childhood?
I'm still pretty frail.
Are you?
No, I'm not. No, I got over both illnesses, and I'm fine now. I've been fine for years.
Ringo Starr is my guest. Today he begins a world tour with his new all-star band. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ringo Starr. So, how did you keep busy while you were sick? Had music entered your life yet? Were you listening to a lot of it?
It's that's where it entered my life, was because to keep us busy, besides letting us knit, they used to let us knit dishcloths.
Oh, wow.
It was really exciting.
Yeah.
And then, teacher would come in with musical instruments, being drums, tambourines, maracas, triangles, all percussive stuff. And she'd put this big screen. I'm trying to let you visualize it out there, Radio Land. Big white paper with red notes for the drums, and yellow notes for the tambourines, and green notes for the triangles. And so she would point to these different colored symbols, and we would either hit whatever instrument we had. Well, I had a drum the first session, and I really loved it. And so they came back like a couple of weeks later, and they tried to give me another instrument, but I only wanted the drum, and that's where I really fell in love with drums.
Was that supposed to be physical therapy for you also, since it's such a physical instrument?
Well, we couldn't get out of bed too often. You know, it was a big deal after 6 months in the hospital when they said, you can get out of bed now and sit on a chair. So that was the big move. But so it was just to keep us entertained. They never really came in giving us maths and geography or things like that. They gave us knitting and making things, you know, paper mache stuff and things like that.
So what was it like for you after you were sick or while you were sick, to be playing an instrument that's so physically taxing?
Well, I didn't have an instrument for years later. I made my first kit when I came out of hospital, out of biscuit tins and firewood. And then when I was about 16, I got a bass drum. That's all I had, was a big bass drum. And then when I was 18, I got my first kit. So I'd strengthened up by then.
And how old were you when you were actually playing in a band?
1 month later.
After you got the kit?
Yeah. Because I was really lucky, because in those days, if you had the instrument, you were in the band. And because it was skiffle, so it was real easy. So that's how the guy next door, it was called Eddie Miles, but we formed the Eddie Clayton Skiffle Group, and he was the guitarist, and my best friend Roy Trafford was the other guitarist, and we got another guy on T-chess bass, and we just went out there and played.
Now, when did you start playing rock and roll?
Very soon afterwards. I left that band, joined another skiffle group, and then I joined a rock and roll band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. And we were still sort of folky rock, and Johnny Guitar, our guitarist, we were playing the famous Cavern Club in Liverpool, and he brought a radio in to plug into. And, you know, you can imagine the size of your speaker on a radio. And he plugged into that, and they threw us off because we were playing rock and roll, as we should have just been playing skiffle and folk blues. So, and then it started. We just went from there, and everyone got amplifiers, of course, and we were off.
Ringo Starr is my guest. So how did the Beatles ask you to join the band after they asked Pete Best to leave it?
Well, they didn't do it that way. You see, Pete Best was still in the band, and I was with Rory.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Pete couldn't make the session, so they asked me to play. And we'd got to know each other in Germany because we were the two bands playing there, the Beatles and Rory Storm. So, you know, we really became friends there. Then we kept back to Liverpool, and Pete couldn't make it one day, and Brian Epstein came and said, would you play the lunchtime session? And I said, sure. And that was it. And then we went for a drink, and that was the end of the story. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me again to play a couple of sessions, a couple of gigs. And I said, sure, you know, because I just happened to have the time. And then I went away to play with Rory to a holiday camp in England, Butlin's Holiday Camp, where you go for 3 months, you play the summer there in the Rock and Calypso Hall. And we were the rock band. And Brian called me on the phone, and he said, you know, would you like to join the Beatles? Well, I said, sure, I'd love to join the Beatles. And I said, when? And he said, today. And I said, well, I can't join today. That was a Wednesday in 1962. And I said, I can't play today because, you know, the band would be out of a job. We'd have to wait till Saturday because by then we could get another drummer. And that's what happened. And, you know, everybody knows the story from then on.
Well, an interesting part of the story is that you showed up for the first recording session
Oh, yeah.
of the Beatles, and the producer
George Martin.
Yeah, I had another drummer all picked out because I guess he didn't know that you had been chosen to be in the band.
No, he didn't know. Well, he listened to the band with Pete Best and didn't think Pete was going to be on the session. And so he didn't know about me at all. And so he'd got this drummer, Andy White, ready, a professional drummer, a session drummer. And I came down and I was just mortified. And he said, "Oh, we've got this real drummer here." I thought, "What am I?" And he didn't want to take a chance because in those days, it wasn't like you could go in the studio and just spend your time there. You know, the session was 3 hours. You were in and out, and that was it. So Andy played on the single, and of course, then we re-recorded it, and I played on the album. And I sort of defy anyone to tell the difference. And that was it. But George Martin has apologized over and over again because I've made him for doing this to me.
Yes, actually, I think he continues the apologies in his new book.
I think he does. Yeah. And he did on Friday when I was with him.
So
I always remind him.
Well, what did you think the Beatles' chances were of really making it? What was your assessment of the band when you joined it?
I joined the band because they were the best band I'd heard. And that was how I played. I moved my career through Liverpool, of course, to, if I could get into a better band, I would. And that's how I did it. My aim was to play with good players, and that's what I did. I mean, the aim was not really to, be big and famous. It was just to play with really good people.
Did you change your sound when you joined the Beatles?
No. That's why they wanted me to play, because of the way I could play.
So when you joined the band, did you have to do, the Beatles haircut and the suit jacket?
Well, that's the famous line, John came on the phone saying, "Welcome to the band, but you'll have to get your hair cut and get rid of your beard." which I did. I didn't have much of a beard then, but I did have my hair swept back. And we had it cut so it fell forward. It was part of the image, and Brian Epstein was moving them into like this image thing too, making them wear suits and, not drinking and smoking on stage. So it was all part of the deal.
Did that come easy for you? Were you comfortable with that?
Yeah, because I'd been in a group that had suits. Rory, Storm and the Hurricane, we were the top band in Liverpool because we had suits. And, everyone else was just like they are now, actually, all sort of scruffed up. But we were professionals. it's all funny to think about it now, but that red suit meant so much.
Red, wow.
Red, and we had green suits, so we could change. Big doings in the 60s, I'll tell you, big doings.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. It's sort of like the comic clown, John had their edge. Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and, I was, "Hi, what's happening?" And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, "Oh, that's what he's like." And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Ringo Starr. Today is the first day of his international tour with his new all-star band. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Our interview with Ringo continues in the second part of our show. Here's more from the recent release, The Beatles, live at the BBC.
Well, she was just 17, you know what I mean. And the way she looked was way beyond your man. Before too long, I
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what it was like to play in the most popular band in the world and then start a new life after the band broke up. We continue our conversation with Ringo Starr.
Is my madness. Drumming is my business.
Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Independence Day, Richard Ford's sequel to his novel The Sports Writer. That's coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Ringo Starr. Today he launches his international tour with his new all-star band. The tour comes to the States at the beginning of July and tours the country through early September. When we left off in the first part of our interview, Ringo was talking about the early days of the Beatles.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting like so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean,
we were young boys and it was exciting where we'd sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know, just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this saying, oh, well, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden, we've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America, and at that time we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out, nobody wanted them. And by chance George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America, and of course he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And of course, you know, the story goes, when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us, and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan, we had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
Well, that first Ed Sullivan performance is one of the watershed moments in rock and roll history. What are some of your memories of
Ed Sullivan?
Of that show.
Well,
yeah.
Ed, you see, I thought we come to America and it was fabulous, and there was millions of people at the airport and they were lying in the streets, and it was yeah all over the place. And just my mind I have of Ed to this day, and I don't know if it's actually true, but my impression was Ed Sullivan, you know, I'm waiting for Ed saying, yeah, they are, they're all the way from England and it's great, they're going to be fabulous and blah 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 blah, and it's like Ed said, here they are, the Beatles.
Well, you probably couldn't
just
comprehend
like
the whole... Yeah.
Thrown to the lions. Right. So, to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
low-key,
square person.
Yeah, we did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show. We'd go anywhere for a gig.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have any idea what was going on? Like why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool, and
so you actually knew where it started.
Oh, I mean, it caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine you're 22, 23, and you go on stage and all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because, you know, we were starting to make really interesting records and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did, people were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become because we could only play, you know, the actual thing. I mean, for me personally, it's very hard to to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the, you know, into the cosmos. So you found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
Do you have a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
I think, well, you see, the very first record, you know, making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling. And listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere, and you'd know, you know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday, they're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car. And listen to it. And the other thing we did, if it moved up the charts, we would always have a celebratory dinner. So if you look at Beatle photos and Beatle footage, you'd see them getting fatter and fatter and fatter as they were getting more popular, because now we could afford food, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the record started to really get exciting. Or, you know, the sound, we were really getting into the sound, making sounds, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. You know, everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites, just because it, I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Being a band as opposed to being artfully produced in the studio? Is that
sure,
what you mean?
Even though we did it ourselves. So, you know, suddenly the strings and the brass were taking the center stage around the songs instead of the group.
Is there a track that you like best for your own work? I'd like...
Well, if you want to play an early Beatle track, you can always play Rain.
Why don't we do that?
Why not?
We'll hear more from Ringo Starr after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Hey. I've been told when a boy gets a girl, take a trip around the world. Hey, 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 my girl said when I kiss her lips.
My guest is Ringo Starr. It's something else about the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were such an important part of music,
life.
Period, you know. And they're really a very small part in your life. I mean, a big part in who you are, but a small
sure.
part in the number of years
sure.
that you were a Beatle.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd like to get a sense of what it means in your life if you still feel... like that is so much a part of your existence, or if that's something that you've really tried to move beyond and away from. And
well, I don't think you can move away from it, because you know, it was only 8 years of my life, but it's the 8 years that everybody really associates with. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't matter. I've made hit records and you know, I had hit albums, and I'm on tour, and that it always comes back to these 8 years of being a Beatle, and I think I just have to resign myself to that's what people want to know about. But of course, in my life, I've moved on. You know, I've done other things. You know, Barbara and I have been together for 15 years. You know, been married 14. So, you know, the love of my life, who's here with me today, listeners. You know, we have our life. We live together. But you know, whenever it comes down to something like this, it's always a Beatle program.
Did you want the group to break up? Were you ready for it?
I think we were all ready in a way because it wasn't as much fun as it used to be. It was okay while we got in the studio for a while and then, you know, there would be some bickering. And nobody wanted to put in the time, including myself. You know, no one wanted to put in the time and energy that it took later on. You know, we may have done the first album in 12 hours, but the last ones were taking months. And, you know, no one really wanted to put in that time and energy. So it was sort of just like a natural falling apart, really.
What was it like for you musically in the early years after the Beatles split up? Was it easy for you to establish yourself as a musical identity outside of the Beatles?
No, I had no identity outside of it, really, for myself. I mean, I was, you know, it was the Beatles. I was in the Beatles. I was one of them, and that's what I did. And suddenly we weren't doing that, so I really had to think about what I wanted to do and, you know, where would I take my musical career or any career. And so it took a while, you know, for the dust to settle that finally it's over. And I well, better pick myself up, dust myself off,
start all over again.
And that's what I did. And, you know, what would I do? So I called George Martin, who, you know, I'd worked with for years, and I decided, you know, I wasn't as prolific a writer as the others. And, you know, I was trying to find myself, so I decided to make an album of nostalgia, really. So I decided to do all the songs that I'd heard at the parties at home, you know, with my parents and my uncles and everybody. And so, you know, I did that album. And then just by chance, I was working with George in EMI, and he'd flown in this steel guitar player called Pete Drake. And I sent my car to pick him up at the airport, and he noticed I had a lot of country tapes in the car. And he came in and said, "Ah, see, you like country music, boy?" I said, "Yeah." And so we got talking. He says, "Well, why don't you come to Nashville and make an album?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not going to go and live in Nashville for months, you know, because I was so used to us being months in the studio." He said, "Months? You kidding? We did Bob Dylan's album in 2 days or something." "Oh, so that sounds good." And so we made arrangements, and I ended up in Nashville, and we actually did the album in a day. No, 2 days. We did 5 tracks a day. It was really speedy, so, you know, that was okay. And then after that, of course, that's when it really took off, was I called Richard Perry because Harry Nilsson and I were in or going to Nashville to do the Grammys, and Richard was going, so I'd worked with him through Harry Nilsson. I said, "Well, while we're in Nashville, why don't we do a few tracks?" So Richard said, "Well, why don't we do this and Nashville stuff, and then why don't we go to L.A. and make a record? See what we get." And that's what we did, and that's when we got to the Ringo album. And then my career was off and running again.
You know, it's funny. Did you feel like...
Did I do all the talking then, Terry?
Did you ever feel like what you wanted to be was a drummer in a band, but what was expected of you was like a masterpiece record because of, you know...
No, all I wanted to be was the drummer in the band, and then sort of this Ringo personality came out, you know, with the Octopus's Garden and Yellow Submarine and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, you know, to make the Ringo album, you know, we had to find tracks that really, you know, would show off different facets of my personality. And Richard Perry, you know, was very good at that, finding stuff. And then we'd listen to it and we'd work it out what we could do together. And also on that album, of course, you know, I did have John who wrote me a song. And I did have Paul who wrote a song. And I did have George. So, you know, everyone was playing, really, but we just weren't playing together.
I know you've been sober since 1988.
Mm-hmm. I am still sober today.
Did you have alcohol or drug problems for much of your career before that?
Well, it didn't seem to be a problem in those days, though, you know, you're younger and you can recoup real easy. And it, you know, I did use and abuse even in those days, but it wasn't on a daily basis. It just sort of caught up with me from sort of 1975, I believe, that's where my real downhill roll started. And, you know, it just got faster and faster and worse, and, you know, blackouts and passouts, and found yourself, you couldn't really handle the day unless you had something change in your attitude, you know, alcohol or drugs of any description. And in the end, it just got so scary and painful and frightening that, you know, I hit my bottom just terrified, and just, you know, God's will and Barbara's got us into a rehab, because I didn't know you did that. And but I was frightened enough to ask, you better get us in one of those places. And that's what she did. And from since then, you know, thanks to them, thanks be to God, I have not had a drug or a drink on a daily basis.
Now, I know your son plays with you in your band.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, like, watch him
watch his every move, the little whippersnapper. No, it's, I don't watch him. He's a really fabulous player. And what is just exciting, it's like, you know, I'm not looking at him all the time, but I just turn around and look over, and there he is. And you've got your son. I mean, it's just an absolute thrill that he's up there with you, you know. And it just goes to prove that, you know, you give him one lesson and watch out. They're up there with you.
So he plays
drums.
So he plays your instrument.
Yeah, and my.
Are you flattered that he plays the same instrument you do? You know, some kids will do anything to not do what their parents did.
Sure. No, he's always been a drummer since he was a baby. He's always been a drummer, but he also plays good piano and good guitar. But the interesting thing with our family is he plays drums, and so does his brother. There's another drummer, so we are the family drummers. You know. But it was hard for Zach at the beginning because he was always compared to me. And as a teenager, he used to take this very badly.
Before you have to leave us, I would like you to choose a track from one of your recent records that you particularly like.
A solo?
Yeah.
I'd like to play from the track Don't Go Where the Road Don't Go from Time Takes Time.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you, Terry.
Ringo Starr begins his world tour today with his new all-star band. The tour comes to the U.S. next month.
I woke up from a bad dream to the howling of a lonely night. Felt the walls come closing in like the victim of a one-way fight. I don't remember many yesterdays. I left alone.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on last night's address by President Clinton on the balanced budget?
Well, reaction today from Democrats. We'll be hearing from NPR's Elizabeth Arnold what the reaction was on Capitol Hill to the president's speech. Some upset among Democrats there. And also from some Democrats from far beyond the beltway around Washington. And there we hear not so much upset with what the president did. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing the latest from Sarajevo, where Bosnian government forces appear to be massing near the city. And we'll be hearing about issues of harassment in cyberspace.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Sports Writer was one of the most acclaimed novels of the 1980s, and now author Richard Ford has written a sequel titled Independence Day. The novel is set in 1988, which makes its narrator, Frank Bascom, 44 years old. Frank has entered what he calls the existence period of his life, a time when transcendent yearnings are punctured by practical worries. Before we hear critic Maureen Corrigan's review, let's hear a short excerpt from the opening of Independence Day, read by the author Richard Ford, in which Frank describes other aspects of the existence period.
A sad fact, of course, about adult life is that you see the very things you'll never adapt to coming towards you on the horizon. You see them as the problems they are. You worry like hell about them. You make provisions, take precautions, fashion adjustments. You tell yourself you'll have to change your way of doing things Only you don't. You can't. Somehow it's already too late. And maybe it's even worse than that. Maybe the thing you see coming from far away is not the real thing, the thing that scares you, but its aftermath. And what you feared will happen has already taken place. And in that very way, your life gets over before you know it. We miss it. And like the poet said, the ways we miss our lives are life.
There's a voice I never expected to hear again. Not Richard Ford's, but Frank Bascom's. Frank was the fallen hero of Ford's 1986 novel, The Sports Writer, one of the most moving books ever written about divorce and loss and the nobility, as well as the absurdity, of just plodding along. You don't usually think of great works of literature as spawning sequels. Part of what supposedly makes them great is that they create complete worlds in themselves. But some fictional characters, like Huck Finn or Philip Marlowe or Frank Bascom, lead such unruly, rich lives that they can barely be contained within the space of one book. They all but demand encores to round out their stories. As the passage you just heard suggests, in the years since his last appearance, Frank hasn't gotten religion or optimism or Prozac. When Independence Day begins, he's still the same gloomy, courageously aware guy he was in The Sports Writer. Frank has returned to New Jersey from a brief fling in France, and he's traded in sports writing for real estate brokering. The job suits him because he has an intimate knowledge of the contingencies of life that uproot people. Frank's ex-wife, Anne, has remarried to a hale and hearty architect Frank loathes. And their 15-year-old son, Paul, has grown into a disturbed delinquent. He sometimes barks uncontrollably and has recently been arrested for shoplifting condoms. Frank desperately wants to believe that a father-son road trip to the basketball and baseball halls of fame might provide the opportunity for Paul to open up to his old dad. In The Sports Writer, Frank's resurrection from the deadening grief of his divorce took place over Easter week. Here, it's the July 4th holiday that gives symbolic definition to the story. Mixing up the Declaration of Independence with the Constitution, Frank tells Paul that the original framers wanted to be free to make new mistakes. That's the very freedom these two men seek as they drive towards historic Cooperstown and become part of a centuries-old traffic flow of Americans searching for something elusive and better beyond a distant hill. And Frank and Paul find it. I can't think of another American novelist besides Richard Ford who could write such an unsentimental, funny, and profound story about a man who's old enough to know better regaining the courage to hope. It's as though Fitzgerald had decided to let Jay Gatsby have a second try at reaching that green light.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed Richard Ford's new novel, Independence Day. Richard Ford will join us to talk about his novel sometime soon on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Kenesha Baker is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Random House, publisher of Hedrick Smith's new book, Rethinking America, a new game plan from the American innovators, schools, business, people, work. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. In Iraq, opposition sources are reporting armed clashes near a state-run radio station outside of Baghdad. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
According to Iraqi opposition leaders, anti-government elements of the armed forces attacked a government-run radio station in Abu Ghraib, just outside Baghdad. The opposition sources say the battle between pro- and anti-Saddam Hussein forces involved helicopters and tanks. They reported that the radio transmission stopped for a short period but then resumed. A curfew was reportedly declared for the area, but the opposition claims could not be confirmed. Reports of unrest from Iraq come amid another shakeup in the country's military leadership, where several top generals, including the Army Chief of Staff, have reportedly been dismissed. Iraq has suffered under 5 years of United Nations economic sanctions, resulting from its invasion of Kuwait in 1990. The measures have taken a heavy toll on the Iraqi economy and have led to several reported coup attempts against Saddam Hussein. I'm Suni Khalid reporting.
The French government told the United States today to stop holding up the deployment of a rapid reaction force in Bosnia. The force needs the approval of the United Nations Security Council. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Foreign Minister Evi Deshahed expressed his exasperation at the United States for delaying a resolution on the rapid reaction force. He said France wants the UN peacekeeping mission in Bosnia reinforced. That still hasn't happened, he said. The United States delayed authorizing deployment of the force because it's worried about the cost of the operation. Since it will operate under UN command, all UN members will share the cost. But France is not going to let up the pressure. Deshahed said, "We fervently want the American government to help get a rapid decision." Deshahed also demanded the release of all the hostages. President Jacques Chirac said yesterday that the remaining Frenchmen held captive in Bosnia would be freed soon. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Australia and New Zealand are joining South Pacific nations in condemning France for its plans to resume nuclear testing. Both countries say they'll limit military ties with France while the testing takes place. France suspended nuclear testing 3 years ago, but new President Jacques Chirac says it'll start again in September to finish an experimental program. Chirac has promised to stop the testing next year and sign a treaty banning such nuclear testing. The man known as John Doe No. 2 is apparently no longer a suspect in the Oklahoma City bombing. The Associated Press is quoting a law enforcement official who says investigators think they have identified the man and don't believe he had anything to do with the blast on April 19th. The official says the man apparently happened to be renting a truck at the same time as bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 2 points. This is NPR. House Speaker Newt Gingrich says President Clinton's balanced budget proposal is a, quote, non-starter. Mr. Clinton wants to balance the budget in 10 years. Republicans want it done in 7 years. But Gingrich says Republicans may be able to find many good ideas in the president's plan and include them in their blueprint. Gingrich says the president has made a great effort at conciliation by agreeing in principle to cut taxes and spending. He says it would be irresponsible to reject the opportunity to work with the White House. The state of Washington has fined the Seattle Fire Department $41,000 for safety violations that may have contributed to the death of four firefighters. Steve Krueger of member station KPLU reports.
The State Department of Labor and Industries investigators found a total of 10 safety violations. The most serious finding was that the Seattle Fire Department did not alert its fire crews that the Mary Pang frozen food warehouse was the target of an arson threat. Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms investigators knew that an arsonist was planning to set a fire in the building's basement. The information was passed to the Seattle Fire Department, but investigators say the information was not passed on to fire crews when the fire broke out. The fire was, in fact, set in the building's basement. Four firefighters fell to their deaths when the fire caused the building's main floor to collapse. Martin Pang, the son of the building's owners, has been arrested in Brazil, where he fled after the fire. He's charged with 4 counts of murder, and he's fighting extradition back to the U.S. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Krueger in Seattle.
Security is tight in Halifax, Nova Scotia. It's the eve of the summit of the 7 largest industrial nations. Part of Halifax's harbor has been closed, and dozens of video cameras are monitoring meeting sites. Air traffic has also been restricted. The Canadian Mounties have reported they are checking a threat against the American delegation coming to Canada, but they say they do not consider this serious. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Iraq has denied reports of a fight at a Baghdad radio transmitter today. Iraqi opposition leaders had told reporters that the unrest involved tanks, a helicopter, and possibly Iraqi troops. Iraq's news agency says the report is nothing more than wishful thinking. But Reuters News Service is quoting Iraqi dissident leaders who say Iraqi soldiers fought each other in the Baghdad region until noon local time. There is no independent confirmation of these reports. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole and House Speaker Newt Gingrich say they're ready to work with the president on his ideas to balance the budget. Mr. Clinton spoke to the nation briefly last night about ways to reduce the federal red ink. UPI's Carol Van Dam prepared this report.
Dole and Gingrich applauded the president for jumping into the budget debate. Dole calling it the responsible thing to do. Gingrich says Republicans would be crazy not to reach out to the administration.
The president last night made a serious effort to be conciliatory. He accepted the principle of a balanced budget. He accepted the principle of cutting taxes. He accepted the principle of not cutting defense. He accepted the principle of reforming Medicare to make sure it doesn't go broke.
But those proposed cuts in Medicare are what prompted a stinging attack from some congressional Democrats. Gingrich says he understands why liberal Democrats are angry with Mr. Clinton, but says other Democrats understand that balancing the budget is the right thing to do. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Israeli troops have shot and killed a Palestinian fugitive and two members of PLO leader Yasser Arafat's elite guard force. The incident occurred on the border between Gaza and Egypt. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli army said the Palestinian fugitive was one of three men trying to cross into Gaza from Egypt illegally when he was spotted by Israeli undercover troops. The soldiers shouted at the group to stop and then fired, killing one of the infiltrators who was wanted by Israel for attacks on Israeli soldiers. The two others killed in the clash were members of the PLO's Force 17, which provides security for Yasser Arafat. They were allegedly there to assist the infiltrators. A PLO spokesman said the two were not involved in guarding Arafat. Israeli security sources say dozens of Palestinians have crossed into Gaza from Egypt illegally in the last few months. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said he hoped an agreement on transferring all civilian powers to the Palestinians can be reached by early next month. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Dozens of gunmen have taken up to 300 people hostage in a southern Russian town. They've taken over government buildings and are trying to move toward the town's airfield. The gunmen are suspected to be Chechen rebels. Houses are on fire. Shots are ringing out. Reports say there are casualties. Television pictures show bodies laying in the streets. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow rose more than 6 points to end at 4,491. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. A boycott launched by environmentalists has hit sales at Shell gas stations in Germany. Greenpeace and other groups are angry with Shell's attempts to sink an oil platform into the Atlantic. NPR's Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
For weeks, Greenpeace has tried to halt plans to sink an oil platform off the coast of Scotland. Shell officials have forcefully ended several attempts by environmental activists to take over the platform. Although the British government has approved the plan, environmentalists say it is an environmental hazard and a dangerous precedent for disposal of dozens of other oil rigs in coming years. The story has been covered extensively by the media in Germany. Shell officials say they cannot quantify the drop in sales, but admit stations in Germany have been hurt by the boycott. German politicians across the political spectrum have protested the planned sinking of the oil platform. Shell claims it is too expensive and dangerous to move the platform to land. The rig contains toxic and radioactive waste. But Greenpeace charges the costs of land disposal are only a quarter of the $72 million Shell has estimated. At a recent North Sea conference in Denmark, Britain was criticized by other European countries for its decision to allow the platform dumping at sea. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The Japanese trade minister says talks with the United States will resume next week in Geneva. The urgent discussions come as the Clinton administration gets ready to impose expensive tariffs on 13 Japanese luxury cars by the end of the month. Washington is pressing Japan to open its markets to U.S. cars. The government says the shells of businesses stacked up 0.8% higher in April. Expensive products continue to pile up in stores and warehouses. A second report says sales dropped 0.4% in April. This could mean there will be cuts in production since there are so many goods available and fewer jobs, since fewer people will be needed to make the new goods. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.